So in this session, I propose sharing with you what the saints say that we can do in this night of the Spirit. We've tried to describe the experience itself, and now let's look at what we are advised to do. Having looked at the night into which we are plunged as we are drawn deeper and deeper into communion with God in contemplative prayer, we seek the advice of the masters of the art of prayer who guide us in the darkness. How are we to sustain what Teresa calls a feeling of strange solitude? The pain of longing and the pain of knowing our own sinfulness. Well, the first thing, and I've touched on this already tonight, that Teresa advises is don't forget that the pain is brought about by the flame of love coming from the heart of God. Nothing stands between the person in this night and the one loved. That's very reassuring truth. And that's all we're looking at this for, because a person in this state could think it's their own sinful. There are many things that can put us into a dark night. A sense of distance from God. Our own sinfulness is a good example. Our own neglect, our own half-heartedness, all of that. So we naturally tend to think that's what the problem is. But at this stage of intimacy, Teresa is assuring us, don't forget that this pain is the pain of love. The journey, though at times painful, is a journey into the arms of the one who has promised himself to us. That will be our subject for next week. Whatever sufferings we have, Teresa says, the soul knows that they're great favours. The soul feels that the pain is precious. The wound, she says, satisfies the soul, much more than the delightful and painless absorption of the prayer of quiet, that lovely honeymoon stage of first encounter that was very beautiful, appropriately so. But this is much more satisfying, though painful. The only one, she tells us, who can remove the pain is the one, the true comforter who consoles and strengthens the soul. Marie-Eugène writes, the divine visits of the betrothal complete the soul's purification, enriching it and preparing it in a positive way for the spiritual marriage. With their extraordinary gifts of love in the depths of the soul, these divine visits destroy or render inactive remaining evil tendencies. The meeting with God in the light, which they produce, perfects the psychological reorientation of the soul. Thereafter, the soul is wholly turned to the beloved. An anonymous author, a monk, and I now think more probably a Carthusian monk, wrote a book called The Hermitage Within, and in it he writes, advising us what to do in this state, tirelessly plead for God to give himself to you. You will be reduced, he says, to wanting to believe, to stumbling along, groaning and no longer understanding a thing. You must behave as if the light were lightening your path. You must deepen your faith not by devouring more and more books, but by humbly submitting to this withdrawal of light and by putting your whole life down to its minutest details under the influence of faith. Humility, he says, will save you. Accept not tasting God's love. You who have savored the love of creatures too much, accept walking in darkness without so much as feeling the fatherly hand bearing you without your knowing it. Guide yourself by his voice. Thérèse of Lisieux, in the last writing of her spiritual autobiography, just a month or two before her death, wrote, "Jesus knows well that while I do not have the joy of faith, I am trying to carry out its works at least. I believe I have made more acts of faith in this past year than all through my whole life. At each new occasion of combat, I run towards my Jesus and I sing what I want to believe." The advantage for me, and hopefully for you, of reading the statements made by the people who've experienced this is that they're very real, they're very... That's what they actually do, and they're very holy people, amazing human beings. So it might give us... We'll all be different. We'll all have to find our own way, as we have to in love and everything else. But their guidance is very encouraging, to say the least, and will surely help us. Just some more from St. Therese. "Holiness," she said, in August of the year of her death, "holiness consists in a disposition of the heart which makes us always humble and little in the arms of God, well aware of our feebleness, but boldly confident in the Father's goodness." And a lovely image, simple image for you mums and dads. She says, "Look, think of a little child that's learning to stand, but doesn't yet know how to walk. In the child's desire to reach the top of the stairs to find his mother, he lifts his little foot to climb the first step. But in vain, at each renewed effort, he falls over. Be like that little child," she says. "Always keep lifting your foot to climb the ladder of holiness, but don't imagine you can mount even the first step. All God asks of you is goodwill. From the top of the ladder, he looks lovingly upon you, and soon, touched by your fruitless efforts, he will himself come down and, taking you in his arms, will carry you to his kingdom, never again to leave him. And if you die at 95, you'll still think that was very soon." She doesn't say that. That's my little addition. So, like Nicodemus, we come to Jesus in the night, walk towards him, asking, "What do I do?" That's what he asked. But we're not just submitting our soul to the words of Jesus, we're actively cooperating with grace. And so, in a letter to a woman friend, John of the Cross writes, "It's a great grace from God when God so darkens and impoverishes the soul that the senses cannot deceive it." As we saw when we read Edith Stein's kind of statement about the night some months ago. She reminds us that the night is dark, but it also protects us. We can also be safe in the dark, safe from what people might do to us. We're hiding in the dark, protected by the dark. So, in the dark, the senses cannot deceive us. "And that it may not go astray, it has nothing to do but walk in the beaten path of the law of God and of the church, living solely by faith, dim and true, in certain hope and perfect charity, looking for all its blessings in heaven, living here as a pilgrim, a beggar, an exile, an orphan, desolate, possessing nothing, and looking for everything from God." Julian of Norwich has this advice for us. Pray inwardly even though you find no joy in it. For it does good though you feel nothing and see nothing, yes, even though you think you cannot pray. For when you are dry and empty, sick and weary and weak, your prayers please me, says Jesus to Julian. Your prayers please me, though there's little enough to please you. All believing prayer is precious to me. God accepts the goodwill and work of his servants, no matter how we feel. So there's the first piece of advice they give us. Know that it comes from love. Stay in the prayer and seek God. That's one, the key thing to do. A second suggestion made by the saints concerns the virtue of hope. God sustains us by the virtue of hope, so that we continue to tend towards a communion with him which we know by faith, but which we do not yet possess in the full measure of love's longing. Our spirit groans because we seem not to be going forward, but we continue to long and to trust in him who we know loves us and whom we love. We are to keep our gaze fixed beyond the storms and the darkness on the one who is drawing us to himself. Thérèse of Lisieux has this lovely image of when you're looking into the eyes of someone, but it's dark, but you know they're still there. So you're still looking into their eyes though you can't see them, but the love knows they're there. So it's an intimate, loving, looking through the dark in trust. The Carmelite Marie-Eugène writes, "The dark night of the spirit brings with this hour of supernatural hope. God reveals himself in the flowing in of grace and the extraordinary favours that mark this period. In that wisdom, secret and always acting, which creates a certain obsession for the divine transcendence. The darkness that prevails makes thicker the veil that separates God and greater the distance. The soul, crushed by its misery and weakness, experiences an inability to go towards God, the only object that henceforth it can desire. To go back it cannot, for it is already captivated by this love. It doesn't succeed in going towards him, and it will not do so, since the divine flame is within it, assailing the soul. This is the hour of profound hope, ardent and peaceful. God awaits the sighs that mount up from the depths of the soul, opening them to his action. God needs these inner groanings that tell that the work of purification is being accomplished and that give up to the flame's action all imperfections." A small clarification on what we mean by the virtue of hope. I used to think that hope meant, in the biblical sense, the scriptural sense, because in English it does mean this, but I used to think it meant longing for something in the future that isn't yet ours. And that's something we do, and that's quite appropriate. But it's not the virtue of hope as I've discovered it in the biblical context. Hope in the New Testament does relate to the future, but I think in this way, that the future is so confidently left in the hands of God that we can focus on the moment, this moment, which is our only moment. So the future doesn't distract us from now, it can, but hope enables us to stay focused. So the fears of the future, which are, after all, normal, but not helpful, because at the moment we don't have the grace even to cope with the future yet, because it's not real till it becomes present. So fear of the future, which hurts us all, looking forward to the future, which can distract us from where we are now, are both not very successful ways of operating. The virtue of hope means my future tomorrow is in the hands of a wonderful God. It's also in the hands of people and myself, so it's random stuff. But whatever happens tomorrow, God will be there gracing me, loving me. And the best way to prepare for it is to live now. So hope leaves the future, trusting to attend to love now. And that is the virtue of hope. In this night of the Spirit, we're being invited to be poor in spirit, conscious of our utter dependence on God and confident like a child in a father's love. Trust is hope impregnated with love. So because we love God, we trust that the future, God will be loving me in the future, and ultimately that's all that matters. We are to abandon ourselves to God. We are being called to cling to nothing, not even to remembered graces, for graces are not God. John of the Cross writes, "It is best to learn to silence the faculties and to cause them to be still so that God may speak." And Marie Eugène writes, "The asceticism of the soul consists in preparing by mortification and purity of heart for the spiritual poverty that God himself works in the soul. In bearing this poverty humbly and peacefully when God gives it as a grace, in protecting it and furthering it according to the grace that is given, by the practice of an interior silence, in this solitude of peace and silent hope, it purifies and flowers." So what do we do in the dark night? First, we've seen, know that the darkness comes from an attraction to love. So it's a love place, even though we may not feel it. Trust that. Secondly, hope. Know, in other words, in faith, that God will always be with me in the next step, however frightening it might look or lonely it might look. God will always be there, and trust that. Thirdly, and most importantly, don't move far away from Jesus. In your prayer or anywhere, stay close to the human Jesus. Teresa stresses that because people in her day, and people still, can invite us into an abstract kind of prayer which seems like prayer, and it may even be a form of prayer that has no connection with the human Jesus. Teresa warns us off that like anything. Don't do it. Stay close to Jesus. She recognizes that sometimes in the darkness it is such that we feel abandoned by God, including having no sense of the presence of Jesus. And if we don't sense his presence, she says, accept that. However, she's insistent that we not be deceived into thinking that we have to try of ourselves to distance ourselves from Jesus. She was advised to do that for many years and tried to do it, and she regretted it. People said, no, don't think of the humanity of Jesus, just think of the transcendent God, or have no thoughts at all. Without Jesus, says Teresa, we cannot enter into the profound areas of prayer. For if we lose our guide, the good Jesus, we will not find our way. Even though we seem to be in darkness, we are walking with the one who is the light of the world. Jesus experienced a profound sense of being abandoned by his Father. It may well be the same for us, but let us remember his words, "If I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw everyone to myself." Suffering with Jesus is purifying of us. It's also redemptive when we embrace it in love. Thérèse of Lisieux, in her acute sufferings, which were physical and mental, wrote, this is Jesus, "O divine word, you are the adored eagle. I love you and you draw me to you. One day, such is my hope, you will come for your little bird, and mounting with it to the fire of love, you will plunge it for eternity in the burning abyss of the love to which it has offered itself as a victim." They're her words. We'd all put it differently, but you can get a feel for what she's saying. Staying with this closeness to Jesus, Marie Eugène writes, "The link that is forged by gazing on Jesus' suffering, or simply the remembrance of the Passion, has brought about changes in the soul in depth. The external trays of the tableau and conceptual forms of thought disappear. The obscure depths of the soul find repose in the depths of the mystery of Christ's suffering. In an outpouring of painful love that finds strength and love in this meeting, the soul that is suffering under love's action joins Christ, who is in agony, in his love for the world until the end of time." And finally, in this closeness to Jesus, once again Marie Eugène writes, "The living presence of Jesus remains with the soul in the dark night, hidden from the senses, but perceived in deeper regions. The soul can travel securely in the darkness and reach the end only in that divine company and in the half-light of the mystery of his suffering." And so, as far as I can glean it from the writings of these people, they're the three main things to hold on to. And now I'd like to turn with you to look at what are the effects of this dark night in the soul. What are the fruits? What emerges according to these saints and their experience? What happens to a person who dares the darkness and pursues the love? Well, the first fruit, this is a quotation from a Carmelite author, "The first fruit is freedom. Those who experience this flowing in of contemplation feel as though they escaped from a dark dungeon and as though the world were an eternal springtime. They draw out much knowledge of God and of self. They also get much humility and become more understanding of others. Many troubles become relative that were once considered major problems. And most of all, they have a loving solicitude about serving God and are determined to do so without recompense." So let's spend a minute on some of those fruits. We'll start with freedom. In the dark night of the spirit, the last cords holding the bird from flight are broken. The last attachments are broken. The last deflections of the will under the impulse of desire cease. Nothing holds us back now from a complete surrender to love. John of the Cross, "You remain in this condition until your spirit becomes so delicate so simple and so refined that it can be one with the Spirit of God according to the degree of union of love that God in his mercy desires to grant. And he continues, O spiritual soul, when you see your appetites darkened, your inclinations dry and constrained, your faculties incapacitated for any interior exercise, do not be afflicted. Think of this as a grace, since God is freeing you from yourself and taking from you your own activity. However well your actions may have succeeded, you didn't work so completely or perfectly or securely, owing to their impurity and awkwardness, as you do now that God has taken you by the hand and guides you in the darkness as though you're blind, along a way and to a place that you know not. You would never have succeeded in reaching this place, no matter how good your eyes or your feet. The place we're being taken to is the inner heart of God. We could never have dreamed of the possibility of doing that on our own. So the first fruit, refined though it is freedom, a sense that we're not attached anymore to anything save God. The second fruit of this very refined darkness is humility. We spent a whole day discussing it earlier, but let's sum it up here now, what John of the Cross says concerning humility. The first and chief benefit that this dry and dark night of contemplation causes is the knowledge of self and of one's misery, one's need for mercy. Besides the fact that all the favours God imparts to the soul are ordinarily enwrapped in this self-knowledge, the dryness and voids of the faculties in relation to the abundance previously experienced and the difficulty encountered in the practice of virtue make the soul recognise its own lowliness and misery, which was not apparent in the time of its prosperity. Now that the soul is clothed in the garments of labour and dryness and desolation, and that its former lights have been darkened, it possesses more authentic lights in this most excellent virtue of self-knowledge, to know myself. It considers itself to be nothing and finds no satisfaction in self because it is aware that of itself it neither does nor can do anything. That's John of the Cross, and as we saw when we studied humility, I think it can't stay there. Humility is knowing I can do nothing of myself, but I am not of myself. I am in the embrace of God. And as Paul said, I can do all things in him who strengthens me. But now there's no fear of pride or distraction. It's simply a loving awareness that God can do everything through us. So firstly, freedom. Secondly, humility. And thirdly, the fruit of the dark night is this psychological reorientation that takes place. We are practiced in learning through our senses. Now the soul is attentive only to God within. And that's where all our learning is coming from. John of the Cross again. As it has never experienced that new feeling which drives it forth and dazzles it and makes it depart recklessly from its former way of life, it thinks itself to be losing ground rather than gaining and progressing, since it sees that it is losing with respect to that which it knew formerly and enjoyed. This soul is now, as it were, undergoing a cure in order that it may regain its health its health being God himself. In such a way does this dark night of contemplation absorb and immerse the soul in itself, and so near does it bring the soul to God that it protects and delivers it from all that is not God. And now the fourth fruit. What we are experiencing is the triumph of God's wisdom. For the transformed soul, united to God in undistracted love, radiates the divine light to those with faith to discern, and so is a powerful instrument in effecting the kingdom of God in the world. Remember that Teresa was the beautiful, active woman all through this period. And what a fruit her loving and life had for Spain, for the faith of millions still, etc. So she was very active in carrying out the will of God in beautiful ways. What a lovely fruit of a purified soul. John of the Cross writes, in the midst of these aridities, darknesses, etc., God frequently communicates to the soul when it least expects spiritual sweetness, a very pure love, and a spiritual knowledge which is sometimes most delicate. Each of these communications is more valuable than all that the soul previously sought. Yet in the beginning one will not think so, because the spiritual inflow is very delicate and the senses do not perceive it. Our faith assures us that the darkness which we are experiencing is the consequence of our being drawn by God into intimate communion with him in what Teresa calls, what we looked at last week, as the prayer of union and the spiritual betrothal. That's our faith, tells us that. Experience of being one with God as the Word is given to the soul as a spouse. During the period of betrothal, the work of the purifying darkness is completed. And there's a special quality to the experience of delight which at times overwhelms the soul. The soul knows that perfect union with God has been promised. That's what betrothal is. I'll now look at what John of the Cross says in his commentary on the Spiritual Canticle. In that sweet draught of God, wherein the soul is immersed in God, it wholly surrenders itself most willingly and with great sweetness to him, desiring to be wholly his, and never again to have anything in itself that is alien from him. Inasmuch as God transforms the soul into himself, God makes it to be wholly his and empties it of all that it possesses that was alien from God. Wherefore the soul is indeed completely given up to God, keeping nothing back. Not only according to its will, but also according to what it does, even as God has given himself freely to the soul. So these two wills are surrendered, satisfied, and given up the one to the other, so that neither shall fail the other as in the faithfulness and stability of a betrothal. And Marie Eugène writes, God has been attracted by the perfume of love arising from the good works that we do. God is conquered by the soul's silent and ardent gaze. A prisoner of love in that sense. God can't resist your silent and ardent gaze. The discovery of the spouse in the light of the spiritual betrothal dispels the darkness and brings comforting peace to the soul. And so we've come to the end of our journey. And by way of conclusion, I'd like to read to you from Angela of Foligno, a very saintly woman of the 13th century, a single woman who became a tertiary of the Franciscan order, didn't actually join the order, but as a lay person, became one of the large Franciscan family that was sweeping through Italy at that time. And this is, in her prayer, she sensed Jesus praying this to her, saying to her in her prayer, "Oh, I love you. I love you, Angela, more than anyone else in this valley, the valley of Foligno. It is I who come, and I bring you unknown joy. I will enter into the depths of your being. Oh, my spouse, I have rested and taken my repose in you. Now possess yourself and repose in me. Love me. All your life will please me, provided that you love me. I will do great things in you. I will be made known in you, glorified and praised in you." And the advice of Elizabeth of the Trinity to us is this simple advice from a woman who's now a saint, declared a saint. Remain silently in God's presence while the soul immerses itself, expands, becomes enkindled, and melts in Him. So, thank you for your patience. Tonight we've looked at, in the context, if you could keep that in mind, in the context of the prayer of union and the betrothal, they're warning us, or they're preparing us, or they're saying to us, it's not all light, like any love isn't. It's a time of, depending on how much purification we need to become pure love, that's the goal. And it'll vary from person to person. But God doesn't want us to be anything but pure love. And so at this intimate level of prayer, there is a lot of pain of self-knowledge, of remembrance of sin, of imperfection and so on. And there's a lot to let go. And they're encouraging us to dare that journey, knowing that the darkness is there because we're being attracted and called into communion with the source of our whole being, with God Himself. So it's about love, and God will never keep us beyond our capacity to hold anything. So God will constantly enlighten and lift and touch and console and deeply touch our soul. But the measure of our longing and the measure of our willingness to be purified of to love, it's all to love, is what the dark night of the spirit is about. So next week we will assume that, and I'll touch with you in our final evening on Teresa's description of her experience of prayer at the very end of her journey, what she will call the spiritual, not betrothal now, but actually marriage, the experience of love in that complete communion with God. So thank you.